Good afternoon, everyone. Jason Katz here, UBS, Managing Director, Private Wealth Advisor, Senior Portfolio Manager. I am really, really excited today to be joined with my friend, the incomparable Ryan Serhant. Let me tell you a little bit about my team before we get into today's conversation. So I'm in New York. Well, actually, I'm in Miami now. Couldn't get back to New York, but I run a 24-person investment team out of the New York City headquarters of UBS. Collectively, we oversee nearly $7.5 billion for individual investors. And we have subject matter experts in every area of personal finance, whether it's certified financial planners, portfolio managers such as myself, lending specialists, et cetera, everything with a dollar sign in our clients' lives. So let's get to the incomparable Ryan Serhant. You know, a little anecdote about Ryan. A number of years ago, pre-Netflix and pre all the success that he's enjoyed, he emailed and cold called me. And the spirit of what he said was something along the lines of, "We have like-minded clients. We're like-minded," as I could see how you present yourself on CNBC and Fox Business News. And I think we could have a lot of synergies. And I respected that hustle. Frankly, I didn't know Ryan at the time or the fact that he was on Bravo's Million Dollar Listing. I took the meeting and the rest was history. I used Ryan personally for my real estate needs and professionally for all my clients, whether it's in New York or Miami or throughout the country. So I am thrilled that he's enjoyed the success. It's well deserved. He is the foremost authority in anything and everything with real estate. So, Ryan, man, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're the man. Thank you so much for having me. Let's get into it. Let's talk.
Let's do it. Let's start with the juicy stuff.
Oh,
Owning Manhattan,
okay.
I can't get enough of it. I grew up in a real estate family, so that's in my blood. Tell us about how that came about, how you picked the agents to be part of the cast, so to speak, how you developed the storylines, and how has it affected and transformed your business?
So most people probably know me, not necessarily from the Netflix show, because it's only been two seasons and people consume content so quickly these days. You can watch an entire series of a TV show over a weekend, and then you're on to the next one, the next one, the next one. But I did a TV show called Million Dollar Listing New York for Bravo back in kind of the prime cable days, and that lasted for 10 years and still plays on repeat in over 100 countries around the world. It's pretty crazy what that model was able to do for the distribution of content. And then I did a bunch of spin-off shows. And so when I decided to start my own company in 2020, because I was a real estate agent from 2008 to 2020 in New York City, I built the number one selling residential real estate team in New York City. I think we did like $1.1 billion in 2018. Which is a lot back then. It's a lot now, but it was definitely a lot back then. I said, you know what? There's a better way to do this. I need to go out and start my own company. No other real estate platform understands how real estate's going to be bought and sold in 2030, and I need to get ahead of the curve as things change, which is what we did. And then Bravo said, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. You're on a TV show about three real estate agents. It would be like watching Law and Order, where all of a sudden one of the detectives starts up their own detective agency. That's fun and great, but that's a totally different show, the format, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe this coming season is our last because you guys are, you know, your lives are changing. And so I immediately created a reel, right? The same way I cold called you. Like, you gotta create marketplaces. You have to create moments. You have to take the initiative and put yourself out there. So I immediately created my own reel of a TV show called House of Serhant, because I was calling the company Serhant after me. And we have clubhouses. We don't have offices. So our clubhouse in Soho. And so we created this like 5-minute pitch presentation, and I took it directly to Netflix, Amazon, Peacock, everybody. And we had everybody was interested, and we sold it to Netflix. And it was a totally different show at the time. It was a little more like Vanderpump Rules-y, you know, reality TV, which is what you want to like hook a network. And then I sunk my teeth into what I really wanted to do, which was redefine kind of the docuseries genre, and use real estate agents, good and bad, everything in between, and just film in real time, not storied. Like the most reality TV is pretty storied, right? There's situations they set up, they go film that party, you know, that dinner, what happens? Oh, she said what? And then you film the fallout. That's an episode. Next episode, oh, there's a party. Someone didn't get invited. Film the fallout. And so it's kind of event and then fallout, event and fallout. That's pretty traditional reality TV. And I didn't want that. I wanted an 8-episode docuseries about the ups and downs of building a business. And that's how it started. They then changed it to Owning Manhattan because no one in Mumbai knows what a Sirhint is yet. And it's important because 300 million people are subscribed to Netflix around the world, and it's a ginormous marketing platform for us. So we went out and kind of put the cast together for season one, started firing people mid-filming of season one. That was never intended. And then did season two, switch things up a little bit as the company has started to get bigger. And my meta plan is, you know, to look back in, let's say, 10 years from now, and my daughter or anybody will be able to put on Million Dollar Listing season one, episode one, that came out in early 2012, and play it all the way through the series finale of Owning Manhattan, and watch a 24-year-old salesperson in New York City cutting their teeth all the way up to either exiting or IPOing an enterprise. And what was that life like as a almost like a Ken Burns level-esque docu, right, in a way? So that's a really long answer to your question.
Well, your hair has come a long way too from the original million-dollar listing, I will say. No, but the show, it's an education about real estate, about Manhattan, about the art of the deal. I mean, it's really good stuff, and I thoroughly enjoy it, not only because I know you, but because it's just good stuff. Appreciate so it. Let me turn to another topic, your use of social media. Yeah. And your leveraging of AI, the convergence of real estate and AI. I'm particularly interested in that. But let's start with the social media aspect. How is that transforming how real estate is bought and sold? And then talk to me about artificial intelligence.
Sure. So we oftentimes in my company don't even refer to it as social media, because it's grown so much from that. Social media is digital storefronts. You have a digital storefront on Instagram. You have a digital storefront on Facebook. You have a digital storefront on now the Oracle-owned TikTok. You have a digital storefront on Redbook in China, so on and so forth. And you have to treat those digital storefronts the same way you would retail in Manhattan, okay? For example, you know, you're headquartered in New York. I'm here in Soho right now. You could have a company that sells bags, and their storefront will be the same, but different on Madison Avenue and 73rd, on Park Avenue South and 22nd, and on West Broadway and Prince Street. It's still the same theme, still the same brand, but the storefront is different because it's telling a different story to a different target audience. And that's how you have to look at social, and that's what we do here. And we have a production company here. Sirhint is a technology holdco that owns the cloud real estate brokerage. It's an AI native real estate brokerage, which I'll talk to you about. I own Sirhint Studios, which is a production company, sellit.com, which does B2B and direct to consumer sales training. And then Simple, which is our kind of AI enterprise product. So, you know, when you then break it down to understanding how storefronts work in your hand, you understand that social has really turned, you know, real estate from a search experience into a discovery experience, which is what I also get really excited about for the future, right? How do you turn home search into something that you need to go search for? I go to Zillow, I go to Sirhint.com, I'm going to search for this, versus I get to discover it based on my exact needs, wants, and desires. And I think AI is enabling us to turn that discovery into actual decisions. So at this company anyway, we're compressing the timeline from first impression in the digital storefront to first showing, either digitally or boots on the ground, because the content and the targeting are actually intelligent. And I think you've seen that, right, in how we market properties, you know, digitally. I think marketing is shifting from pretty photos to, you know, proof. And I say that all the time. You know, the bad P word is pretty. The good P word is proof. So instead of just showing something that's pretty online to attract eyeballs that then do nothing for you, how do you show something that is proof online that then has a clear call to action, whether that's proof of lifestyle, you know, whether it's maybe it's an apartment in West Hampton that has a great sunset view, right? Proof of light, proof of flow, proof of neighborhood, I don't know, proof of price logic, delivered to the right buyer at the right exact moment. It's how we're thinking about things. And then our strategy with AI outside of just how we go and work with the customer is we replace administrative tasks for back office sales people and sales teams. So our software is called Simple. And we took a hard turn against how all of our competition is using AI to sprinkle it on top of software they currently have to make it a little bit more faster and a little bit more intelligent. And we just built from the ground up a new way to interact with your screen to get the same work done. So it replaces admin, it replaces guesswork, replaces follow-up, you know, all the decks and the things that we right. have to create.
Yeah. I'll tell you, real life, the person that helped me with our transaction actually saw it through the video that you folks posted. That buyer wouldn't have materialized otherwise. And I think there's an acting background somewhere in your past. Tell me, in terms of your content, I mean, it's really funny, it's really engaging, and yet at the same time, it's a serious subject matter. These are people's, you know, homes that they're buying and selling. Who writes your content? Is that all just from you, or do you have people that help you out?
Unfortunately, it's mostly from me. You know, I think the big difference between how we do social and how a lot of, you know, my competition does it is like, I actually like it. I do actually enjoy it. I have fun creating. I did come to New York to do theater and I ran out of money and I got my real estate license to pay my rent. So I didn't have to move home to Colorado. That was the mission. If I could make $2,000 a month, I could stay in New York City and not have to move in with my parents. Today, I feel like kids are like, no, I'll just stay home. But in 2008, no way. And so I do like it. I do like creating it. I do have a team now. You know, I have a production army here. I have two people who just work for me. So they're strictly on kind of like the Ryan Serhant direct payroll that help with a lot of the editing, and the creation. And they've gotten to know my voice so well that even if I have a good idea for a piece of content or a property tour, a lot of what we do obviously is property tours, right? Real estate tours. How do we innovate that first substantive contact with a potential customer through their phone, that they will say, oh no, what if we do it this way? Or what if we think that way? So it's a team, but a lot of it just comes from me.
Good stuff, man. Really, really enjoy it. Now let's get down to business and the serious stuff. We have people throughout the whole country on this call, but let's talk New York City, because I think they too are interested in your answer here. We've elected a mayor in New York City who's campaigned on stronger rent controls and protections, tighter landlord rules. How has this policy initiative affected the buy and sell market? Has it forced the hand of people to migrate to other markets you're in, like here in Miami, where I know you have a big presence? So unpackage that, because I'm really curious about what's happened subsequent to the election as it relates to New York City.
So far, what has happened has probably been a losing proposition for the constituency that Mamdani is actually trying to help.
Interesting.
Because what he's done thus far is either incentivize high taxpayers in New York even further to decamp to low tax states when needed. So we have a massive operation in Florida, right? I just mentioned Miami. I mean, we're up and down each coast of Florida. We do a significant amount in Palm Beach. So he's done that. What he's also done is he's made it difficult to create new housing. Now, he's only been in office for a month, right? So he hasn't done a whole lot yet, but the conversation has been around not actually allowing an easier build process and an easier create process, which has pushed investment around. And all that's done to current existing real estate in New York City, or real estate that is coming, that's already been approved, it's coming, you know, shovels are in the ground. It's just made them even more expensive, because policy uncertainty doesn't kill New York demand. It changes where investors deploy and then how they underwrite, you know? So when rules tighten, or you say you're going to tighten them, I think capital then just prices more risk. Value migrates towards assets with cleaner operating assumptions. So, hey, instead of investing into a fund that's going to do, you know, low-income housing or homeless shelters, we're going to let's just go buy some penthouses, because they're probably not going to build a lot of new ones in the next 4 to 5 years. And they're just going to become more readily valuable. And so we've seen the most incredible influx of luxury residential purchasers to New York City in my entire career. Like, we have in a way that I never thought I would see. Like, there are buildings now that are already in the ground. Nothing else is going to come new while he's in office, most likely. But in the ground, where we were pro-forming pricing and saying, you know, maybe $7,500 a foot expensive, right? Now, we're pretty confident we can get north of $10,000 a foot, which puts pressure on the buyers, creates more tax revenue for the city, but I don't think is what the mayor was intending to have happen. But when you don't understand micro or macroeconomics, and you don't understand that this isn't pro-tenant or pro-landlord, it's just predictable rules for more supply and unpredictable rules equal less supply, then what did you think was going to happen? And you can't bet against New York. So, I mean, so far, so good. But listen, like, I think things are too expensive, for sure. I think the process to get approved for a rental apartment in New York City is completely insane. I think there needs to be a lot of fixing in New York City, but you have to lead from a platform of creating and not taking. And until someone can do that, we just buckle up, and we've been through worse.
I'm assuming he hasn't called on you or other thought leaders in the space for your opinion.
No, of course not. No, I am pro New York, right? I'm not pro any politician. I'm not pro Trump either. I am pro the United States of America. I am pro New York City. I want New York to be the state and therefore the city where companies all over the world are saying, how do I headquarter there? I just raise a bunch of money. I got to go open in New York City because I can hire the best talent. New York City has the greatest innovation programs for underserved youth that are creating some of the greatest minds in the United States, let alone the world. We need to create jobs there. That's what you want. You want incentive, right? You don't want handcuffs on innovation. And so I am pro this mayor. I'm Donnie to win. Of course, I want him to make great decisions. I want him to be great for the city. I hope he is. I'm an optimist by profession. So fingers are crossed. Happy to work with him and everybody. I just want what's best for New York and the New Yorkers who pay for New York to exist and wake up every day and do the jobs that are needed to keep the city running.
Ryan for mayor.
No kid.
So I heard you on CNBC with Kelly Evans the other day, and I thought it was an interesting conversation. The president's focus has been geopolitically, and I think now with the midterms in the not too distant future, the focus will go to domestic policy a la affordability. And there's all this talk about the government buying mortgage-backed securities or mortgage portability or cap on interest rates on credit cards and all the using your 401k as a down payment for a home. And I heard you describe it something like, that's like, you know, the symptoms, that's not the disease. I'm probably messing up what you said, but speak to that, because I thought your answer was amazing.
Well, thanks. I'm trying to remember exactly what she said. You know, what I'll tell you, and I was just thinking about this kind of to your last point too. You know, I want to make sure people understand, like, there is no better place than New York City, for better or for worse. And I don't think that there's a one-way exit, right? I think we're seeing more people create two home strategies more than anything. You know, we see that in Palm Beach right now. Like, I represented the purchaser for the largest residential purchase of all of 2025. It was for multiple lots altogether.
Dare I ask how much?
In Palm Beach for just under $300 million. I did the deal over the phone. But it's a private equity mentality towards property these days, where why own one lot if I can own five for five times the price and retain ownership and my option value, not his or his or his. You know, and you're seeing that now in luxury in a way that we've never really seen. I think to your, you know, what's coming out of DC question, I think most affordability proposals probably typically boost demand. I think demand side help without supply side reform just bids prices up, which is what we're seeing across the board. And I think the only durable fix is to build more homes, build them faster, build them cheaper, and build them in more places. I think what I did say to her in comparing the symptoms versus the disease, it's like Americans across the spectrum don't need more rhetoric. They need more roofs. Less rhetoric, more roofs. Like, just shut up and create policy to allow more people to build. Build more houses. You want prices to come down? Create more inventory. You know, create different types of inventory. It's just mind-boggling. To me, and when we don't, you have to remember, like, the United States now, given how people operate, the United States is a company just as much as every individual state is. So we're now no longer competing, whether we're Florida or whether we're New York, with other states for employees, aka citizens who pay taxes. We're now competing at a global scale. You don't have to work here. You know, you can. Puerto Rico's nice. Grand Cayman is nice too, right? So is Uruguay. It's beautiful. It's great. Basically the same time zone. And then you can travel back and forth, you know, just swap seasons. Why not do that? Hong Kong's a great place. You know, there are incentivized marketplaces that aren't necessarily the United States that we now see our purchasers looking at a global scale. I don't know if I answered your question, but
let me drill down a little bit further. I know you've talked about government-owned land or providing tax incentives for building or converting, you know, some commercial space that's laying dormant into residential and not making the permitting process so onerous. Like, these are common sense policies. Why do you think they're not going down this path?
Well, I mean, because, you know, how do I answer that question without getting in trouble? Policy can't repeal math, right? Like, it can't subsidize your way out of a shortage. Housing affordability is a supply problem. Like, it's like lipstick on a pig, right? Like, housing affordability is a supply problem wearing a demand costume, if that makes sense. I do think taking advantage of government-owned land and repurposing it is great. I think there are office buildings. There's a lot of government-owned buildings that through the whole Doge thing did come available. It's just hard and incredibly expensive if there aren't tax credits attached to converting that type of property to anything other than what it's currently built for. Like, for example, one of the best things, that's the wrong phrase, but I'd say one of the most constructive things to come out of the early 2000s in New York were real estate tax abatements to incentivize builders after 9/11, because no one wanted to live here. No one wanted to move here. No one wanted to build here. And so they created the 421A and the 421G tax abatement. It was before my time, but it incentivized private developers to buy property and defer all real estate taxes for between 10 to 25 years, depending on the asset, right? Depending on the deal. Sometimes there was an affordable component. Sometimes there was a city residential health component. Like, you have to add a school and grocery stores and a new entry into the subway, stuff like that. And then they got to pass on those real estate tax savings, which is a monthly cost, real dollar for dollar savings to the owners. What? Like, genius. It's not that hard. We already pay tax on absolutely everything we do. I don't think real estate taxes, and I know they're discussing this in Florida, whether it ever goes through or not, paying a fee to own your land that you already paid the fees for to attain is somewhat insane. I think doing away with real estate taxes and finding aggressive new tax revenue from the creation of new jobs and new housing is 100% the way to go. I don't think barring institutions from purchasing residential homes is going to do anything. I think it is good rhetoric. And I think voters will pay attention to it. But if you really look at it, only, I think it's less than 2% of all single family homes were sold to quote unquote institutions. They just get talked about a lot. I think mortgage portability in the residential space would make a huge difference. You know, if you're buying a building, if you buy a commercial building, you can assume a commercial interest rate on that property, which is incredibly helpful. You can't do it residentially. They just don't let you, which has created this massive locked-in effect where sellers don't want to sell because they have a 2.5% or 3% rate. Why would you go and buy a new house and pay 6%? And why would a buyer buy your property if they have to pay 6% too, unless you could assume that rate? And what's potentially going to make this all worse might be good for me and my business, because this is what we operate in, is the Trump Platinum Plan. You didn't even ask me about it, but I think, assuming that moves forward, you're going to see luxury real estate and land prices increase 30%. It'll bring in a significant amount of money, but you have no idea how much cash is waiting on the sidelines globally to own a piece of the United States. And it's probably a much bigger deal to talk about than has actually been given any credit on CNBC.
Yeah.
Well, there's north of $6 trillion on the sideline in the world that I'm in money markets. But let me take a step back. The setup for the economy in the U.S. and for markets, at least in our view, is pretty constructive between tax cuts from the One Big Beautiful Bill, deregulation spurring capital market activity, interest rates likely going lower, albeit at a slower pace than I think people are anticipating. So it's probably a good setup for the economy and probably the cyclical parts of the stock market. But what does that portend for real estate, not just in New York, but nationally? So like, widen the lens for me.
We are incredibly bullish on 2026. Not sure where we'll be in 28, 29, especially because I just read Andrew Ross Sorkin's book, 1929. Have you read it yet?
Sure have.
Terrifying. I mean, different world, kind of, but still, everything's cyclical. Even the weather, you couldn't get back to New York because every 10 years, the last time was 2016, we get hit by some crazy, I have 3 feet of snow on West Broadway in Soho. It's nuts. Anyway, we're incredibly bullish on the future here. There is no inventory. There's significant demand, but residential real estate is rate sensitive and supply starved. Like, so you get fewer transactions, whether they're cash or finance. A market like New York City is 65% cash right now, you know, unless maybe unemployment spikes, in which case you'll have a sell-off. But I haven't seen any leading or lagging indicators towards something like that happening. I think commercial is actually probably pretty split. I think trophy commercial assets do fine. I think there will be distressed resets. You're seeing that right now. There's a lot of headlines. And I think conversions of whether it's government office buildings or kind of class B, class C fringe commercial assets, conversions of those will be a great opportunity set. And so you're starting to see that more and more, which just creates a lot of opportunity. You know, you talk about social media, like information travels so quickly now. You know, we go into the weekend in a bear market. By Tuesday morning, we're in a bull market.
Taco.
Yeah.
Trump always chickens out.
Yep, 100%. I think the theme right now is quality for liquidity. The best assets are trading, and they will trade at an incredible premium. I think the rest just needs pricing or reinvention.
Yeah, I like the fact that you use the operative word asset, because it leads me to my next question. So in my world, in the old days, people bought stocks, they bought bonds, they had some cash. And now that has broadened to include alternative investments, private equity, hedge funds. Now it includes art. Now it includes crypto. Real estate is increasingly becoming part of the conversation in the wealth management world as an asset class. Now, I know you're going to talk your own book, as you should. What's your view on real estate being a component of someone's financial plan and their asset allocation?
I got a text this morning from a very well-known client of mine, globally well-known, has really wanted life, that is for sure. He texted me this morning, can't talk, need you to find me, minimum 500,000 acres out west, don't care, low tax, hopefully there's a house on it, needs to come with management, don't care about the price, need to land grab. Word for word, the text. Missing some punctuation. And I never, and I've worked with this guy for like 12 years, like, he's just not the type to own, you know, a million acres in a state he's never going to go to. That said, real estate has become the third pillar. It is a real asset with utility. There's potential for income. And if it's not cash flow, exciting, it's great appreciation. And it provides for increasing inflation sensitivity, right? It diversifies portfolios because it's driven by local supply and demand, and it's not just driven by you know, national or global markets. And I think for high net worth investors, the question isn't should I own real estate? It's how much real estate should I own? How much liquidity do I want? And what mix between core value add, development, or private credit matches my time horizon? Those are the questions we're having. Those are the conversations we're having with you know, your clients across the board as they diversify into hopefully a great but obviously unknown future.
Yeah. So let me end on this note. You're what I refer to as a kick the sheets guy, meaning you get up in the morning, you kick the sheets, let's hit the ground running. I see your videos, you working out and all that. But for real, I mean, you have this energy about you. Tell us what motivates you and what would you impart as advice to other people getting into client-facing businesses, whether it's my line of work, whether it's your line of work. Give us a little inspiration to end the conversation.
I am obsessed with solving problems. I think it is a disease potentially, but it is a clear obsession. Whether it's a problem someone has for me of, I need to find a 4-bedroom on the Upper East Side. My kid just got into Dalton. I got to figure this out. Or like the text message I got this morning to find 500,000 acres. You know, I believe if you can figure out what problem it is that you're solving, then you're never selling anything in any customer or service based industry. You become somebody who gives relief to the clients that you're working with. And then your job becomes fun because you get to wake up every day and just go do puzzles. I have to do puzzles. And I think the message that I give myself a lot, especially, you know, over the past couple of years, as our company has just expanded and grown and scaled, and it just seems like the answer is always more instead of less these days, is just to take a step back and always remind myself that the hard times that you're kicking the sheets to go experience today are the good times. And the good times are just the normal times, right? The good times are your base, that's the base salary. That's it, it's just normal. The hard times, that's bonus, right? That's exceeding expectations on your performance review. And like when you think that way, then every tough conversation, every dead deal, every firing, all the stuff, it doesn't ruin your day, it doesn't ruin your week, it doesn't ruin your month anymore. It's actually something that you're going to miss because the problems you're going to be solving in a year, 2 years from now are going to be so much worse. You're going to look back and say, man, remember when my problems were a little bit smaller, man, those were the good times.
I knew you wouldn't disappoint with that answer. So I'm grateful. I'm grateful that you joined us today. I'm grateful that you cold called me however many years ago that was. I'm grateful in terms of the good work you've done for me personally and professionally for all of our clients. And I appreciate the partnership. Obviously, people know how to reach Ryan. And if you don't, you could reach me. And if you want to reach me, it's jason.m.katz@ubs.com. I could be found on the Fox Varney Show every Monday at 11 a.m. If you want to be on our distribution list as far as our discussions with thought leaders like Ryan, email me and I'll get you in the loop. Ryan, thank you, my friend. You're great.
Thank you. And thank you to everybody who took the time to listen. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Have a great evening.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional guidance. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and broker services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the arrangements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review our client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and a member of FINRA and SIPC.